Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. Hope you're doing well. Hope you're staying healthy. And in just a little bit, we are going to be talking to, where is her book? We're going to be talking to Amy Argentzinger of The Washington Post, who has one of the most surprising and enjoyable books I've read in a long time. There She Was, The Secret History of Miss America. It's fabulous. But right now, we've got Claude Jennings doing all the important work. We've got David Aldrich, who looks like he has a lovely glass of Pinot Noir in his hands.
How did you know it was Pinot?
Because I think you're a Pinot kind of guy.
No, actually, I don't drink Pinot. This is very rare for me. I'm a Shiraz.
Wait, let me call Michael Sands and get that case back. and welcome back, Chuck Ready? Culpepper, one of our favorite Washington Post world travelers. Chuck, how are you? Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm okay, I suppose, at the end of a college football regular season.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to do a little sad happy trails at the beginning, and then we'll go right to fun stuff like sports. Claude and I were talking before the show, and a couple hours ago, I was thinking to myself, I'll just do a brief mention of Bob Dole, who really was one of the good ones. But I realize about once a month now, I have to say something about some person for whom I worked with or for who has died, which is making me seem really old. But Bob Dole was the best, and he was funny, and he was in it for all the right reasons. So God bless him and Elizabeth Dole, and just wonderful. And then David and Chuck, I just heard about Fred Hyatt from The Washington Post, who has passed away. I don't know what you're, because I don't know how long he's been on the, he was on the editorial page for a long time now, but Chuck or David, I don't know what your experience with him has been, but.
Honestly, I didn't have one with him, Tori. He came at well after I had left the Post. Obviously I knew who he was and very respected. I think when someone writes for editorials, it's never enough. People always disagree with them and criticize them. So I know it was a completely thankless job. But I think he was, I'll say this, what I do know, Fred, because I know people that worked with him, was that he really loved the institution of the Post.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that's, I can get with people like that because I believe in the institution of the Post. And,
and he believed in the industry. And I mean that in the best sense of journalism. Yeah. Absolutely believed in it. Chuck, did you know him? Did you encounter him at all?
I didn't, but I have a dear friend from college who I was texting with today, and she worked with him for the last 4 or 5 years. And she said there's just big sadness.
Yeah.
So
I was saying to Chuck and to Claude before the show, David, some years ago, he had some heart issues, and I believe in a big time operation. He lived a few streets away from here. And so he was constantly walking. He was very diligent about taking care of his health.
Yeah.
But, you know, I say I worked with him, obviously on the other side of the fence, but I've worked with him for, more years than I care to remember, close to 40, including when he was on the editorial side. And there was nobody better. Like, just a total professional. He wasn't going to give you more than you deserve, but he was going to listen to you. And sometime it's not appropriate to do on the show, but I'll tell you guys a story about a really, really challenging situation. Had nothing to do with any job I had a couple of years ago. And he just handled it so spectacularly. So best wishes to his family, to Pooh, Nate. One of our kids went to school with his son, Nate, and just wish them the best.
Yeah. Can I say something about Bob Dole, though?
Absolutely.
Because I didn't know him at all, obviously. But I was... What I've told you, one of my favorite books is What It Takes.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, just it's an incredible book, you know. And as you know, a lot of it is about Bob Dole.
Yeah.
And it was just, that's the part of the book that I just remember more than anything else, that this, I mean, wow, to come back from what should have killed him in Europe during 1944, he shouldn't have been around, and to figure out how to function.
Yes.
Much less to rise to be a really prominent deal-making Republican politician for 25 years. Right.
And again, in the best of ways, when he, to your point, David, and I believe he got badly, badly injured, back broken, neck broken, lost a kidney, all sorts of things. It was near the very end of World War II. I mean, it was just about to be over and he got injured. But it was years of surgeries and rehab. And
right.
We went to his childhood home in Russell, Kansas. He took us downstairs in this, you know, think of a basement in Russell, Kansas. And these horrible looking pulleys and other devices he had essentially jerry-rigged on the walls to help him get his arm strength back on the one arm that worked. Yeah. He was incredible.
Right.
Okay, right. I can't help myself. I now have to tell the Jack Kemp story.
Okay.
Hi, Amy. Amy's here. Okay, so he decides, Bob Dole decides for who knows what reasons, Jack Kemp was going to be his running mate, right? Jack Kemp, very attractive guy, very fun guy.
Football.
Football, yes, quarterback.
Yes.
Good football player. So many stories I could tell about. Here's the best one. So, the usual whatever about picking your running mate. And again, all Bob Dole cared about was getting the Republican nomination. But then you got to go through some other motions. They were like, Bob, you got to pick a running mate. Okay. So he decides it's going to be Jack Kemp. They do the background check. Great. Wonderful. Conversations had. Great. He's going to be the nominee. And we're going to announce his vice presidential pick in Russell, Kansas. And these are in the days when people actually cared about these kinds of things. It's a big deal. It's a production of this and that, whatever. And Jack Kemp was a character. But anyways, we're in Russell, Kansas. Jack Kemp is being flown in on a private plane. John Buckley, for whom I worked at the time of the campaign, is going out to the airport to collect Jack Kemp and bring him to Russell, Kansas for the announcement. And we had done a really, really good job. The information had not leaked. People really didn't know who the nominee was going to be, those kinds of things. And John is driving in from the airport with the vice presidential nominee in the car with him. And John calls me in like huge satellite phones at the time.
Yeah.
And John says, hey, we got a problem. And I said, yeah, you're late. Well, where are you guys? I mean, Jack Kemp was famous for being late. He goes, no, we got a bigger problem. I said, what's that? And he says, he doesn't want to do it. And I said, who doesn't want to do what?
What?
And he says, Kemp doesn't want to do it. And I said, what does he not want to do? And he goes, doesn't want to be the nominee. Like, well, sorry. We've got an announcement in 45 minutes. Oh my God. So anyways, John just kind of slapped him around and got him there. We announced him. He was great. Okay.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was great.
Full feet in the car to the,
yeah. Oh. To the don't want to do it. Let's go this way. Divert. Yeah. That's so great.
Tori, okay. If I could interrupt you, I mean, yes, just for one other, like, so everyone that I've worked with in media who's either worked with or for Jack Kemp, love Jack Kemp.
Love.
Like, how Jack did you Kemp. Find? Is he okay? Okay.
Love Jack Kemp.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Here's how much I love Jack Kemp. He was just a piece of work. So we're going through, you know, he's been named and then he's going to start doing interviews and all these kinds of things. Oh my God. And Amy's listening to this going, what show is this?
When do we start talking about sports, Amy?
Jack Kemp in that kind of 1980s way. And remember, this was the 90s, was kind of a good looking guy. Like a lot of hair.
Yeah. Salt and pepper.
Fitted shirts, big watch, these kinds of things. And he always had custom made shirts with his initials on the cuffs.
Yeah.
Which was just a personal thing for me. I hated those. And I just thought, any guy who's thinking enough about initials on a shirt has got too much time on his hands. So this was in the early days, and I barely knew him. And we're in some meeting and this and that, and we're talking about his first big interviews. And I said, okay, and you got to lose the shirts with the cuffs and this and that, whatever kind of thing. Anyways, he turns on me in front of a bunch of people and says, that's ridiculous. I can't believe you said that. God, I mean, just like rips my head off in front of a bunch of people. I'm like, oh, well. Okay. And so I sit down and I type a memo. And those are the days when you typed a memo. I typed a little memo, like, you know, dear, you know, wannabe vice president. And I said, boom, 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 laid out my thoughts, these kinds of things. And I, like a PS, don't ever do that again, because I'll walk in a heartbeat. To his credit, the next meeting, he apologized. And he said I was right. What was the other thing? We're going through, you know, all the questions you would get asked in the big interviews, boom, 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 boom. And okay, you're like number 95 potential question. Have you ever done drugs? And he goes, no, of course not. And then he goes, well, what kind of drugs? I'm like, oh, okay. Let's take a pause here. And it was great because he was is it the Christian Scientists who don't, yeah, no medicine, not medical doctors?
I think you're right, but I don't want to say you're 100%.
I don't want to malign a whole group,
exactly.
Chuck.
I know what you're talking about, but yes.
A Scientologist?
No.
Whichever one it was one of those beliefs, which he was very sincere about, did not believe in using traditional medicine. And it was a big controversy for him in his football career.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want to use the painkillers and everything else. Think about when he played. They just shot him up like crazy, right, David?
Sure. Yes.
But then he eventually did because he wanted to play and be successful. Sure. So there was that. Okay, last story, and then we'll get on to the show because it's almost over. We went through all these questions, so we had thought about everything. And then I said, okay, anything else we haven't thought about? And he goes, well, we should talk about OJ. Ooh. And I said, what? He was very good friends with OJ Simpson. And OJ Simpson had called him, Jack Kemp, repeatedly through his troubles and when he was in prison. And Jack Kemp would never return his phone calls.
Ooh.
And no, Jack Kemp, to his credit, said, I'll go to my grave feeling badly about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, he felt very badly about it. Hmm. Oh, no, he was great. He was great. Okay. And I was 5 or 6 months pregnant at the time when I was working with him. And he was just hilarious. He goes, no, put her in front, the pregnant lady in front. That's great.
Nice.
Okay. We got to talk a little bit about a few things and pretend they're book related. Yeah. We should be talking about the Washington football team, but we won't.
Okay.
We should make
talk
fun
about the Steelers, big win.
No, I can't. I got too many teams to worry about. I got to worry about Michigan. I got to worry about Wake Forest. I got to worry about the Caps.
I didn't know Wake Forest was in a bowl. Did they make a bowl?
I believe it's the Gator Bowl.
You're in the Gator Bowl? Okay.
Yeah, I believe it's the Gator Bowl. They lost to Pitt the other day, which was a quandary.
You did.
We should talk about Brian Kelly's Southern accent, but we don't have time for that next show. So spectacular.
Oh, my God.
Okay, but I'm going to go to Chuck on this one first and then David, because I think this is actually important. China, the WTA, and the diplomatic boycott of the Olympics. Does it make any difference? Will it in any way change China's behavior and or any other professional leagues? I really thought the Women's Tennis Organization was very brave in what they did.
Absolutely.
And how they did it. I did not see a lot following them. But Chuck, World Traveler, you first.
It's almost otherworldly what they did.
Right.
I can't believe it was on this earth that they did that.
Right.
Talk about that, because I was stunned too.
I just can't think of anything that is any more admirable that I've come across, you know. I'm sure I can, but not it's way, 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 way up there.
Yeah.
And I think if, you know, I don't see a whole lot of following about to go on, but if it did happen, would I think it would make any change? Not really, but I think it might hurt a little, in just in terms of you just watch these countries around the world. I used to live in the UAE and it was like this, an entirely different thing, but sports brings a prestige and a bit of respect to them that they love having.
Right.
So in that sense, you know, if we had others to follow, it would be sort of a dent in the, I don't know if it would enact any change, make them start thinking any differently, but it would feel better.
Yeah. Yep. Diplomatic boycott. Does that do anything of the Olympics?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not going to stop anybody from going.
We had our tickets all booked and the Chinese government canceled all of them. So they had this very specific ways you're supposed to get to Beijing, you know,
wow.
So it's very, even more, maybe a little more heavy-handed than we thought.
Wow. David, does it matter?
Oh,
diplomatic
God.
Boycott?
I mean, I don't think the boycott matters at all, because first of all, nobody understands what it is. Are the athletes boycotting? No, they're not. They're competing. What do I care if a bunch of politicians don't go? Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, nobody cares about that. I mean,
you know who? Okay, a brief commercial break. You know who really cares when they heard that? People, generally, it's the vice president and the vice presidential staff who
gets
to go to
sure.
Things. So they're going, damn it. Damn, I thought it was
going to
go to the Olympics.
But kudos to the WTA. I mean this sincerely, because that, boy, I am reminded. I used to watch this great show in the 80s called NBC News Overnight, which the great Linda Ellerbee was on. She was the anchor.
Oh, fabulous.
And she's a hero of mine, a journalistic hero of mine. And she would read letters from fans on the air. And they got a letter from this incredible racist guy who just all these awful stereotypes and things, blah, blah, blah. And he said, I watched you every night, and then went into this racist diatribe. And she said, you know what, sir, turn off the TV. We don't need the viewership that badly, you know? And I thought about that when I thought about the WTA, because no, this isn't going to change China's behavior one bit, but the WTA is like, you know what? We don't need we don't need this.
Yeah.
We don't need this. Like, it's not worth it to us. And I applaud them for that, for being willing to live with the courage of their convictions. Good for them.
Yeah, I agree. In the 130 authors we've had on this show, three of them. So Jim Stravitas, Miles Copeland, and Ken Follett.
Yeah.
All talked about how China, my words, not our authors, messed with their books.
Oh, sure.
Because they didn't like small acknowledgments that China might not be the nicest people.
Absolutely.
Chinese government may not be the nicest people in the world.
When the NBA went through it a couple of years ago, I mean, the NBA is a pretty big, strong, famous league with famous people in it. And they completely went pause up.
Right.
They did. I mean, you know.
Okay, we got two very quick book-related things, because Amy's now kind of going, oh, I get it. This is just a book show.
Whoever booked me on the show is going to be fired, Amy's thinking for herself.
Okay, so here's a book that none of us will ever read. We should, but it's called The Age of AI by, wait for it, Henry Kissinger, Eric Schmidt of Google fame, and a guy named Daniel Huttenlocher, who I believe is an MIT professor. It's about AI. So this very funny guy from the New York Times named Kevin Roose decides he's got to do a review of the book, but he doesn't want to review it. But he says, this is about AI. So he enlists one of these online AI services. And it's a little bit like, I don't know if you guys have it, but I have it because I can't spell. You start to spell a word and then Google or whatever it is finishes it for you.
Spell check.
Okay. So I'm going to read something to you. And you guys, Chuck and David, you have to guess which is his part of the review and which part is the AI system that wrote. Are you ready? Okay. I'll do this quickly because Amy's falling asleep up there. I can tell. Okay. One of the most inspiring aspects of this book is its scope. The authors delve deeply into the potential of AI in all areas of human enterprise. They describe the impact of AI on healthcare, economics, geopolitics, law, urban development, governance, journalism, the military, and even the life sciences. Although AI is already making our lives better in many ways, Kissinger, Schmidt, and Huttenlocher, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, cautioned that it will take us as a species, many years to create a system as powerful as we deserve. So which of those were done by Kevin Roose, the guy doing the review, and which by the AI system he enlisted?
You want to go first?
Chuck, alphabetical.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, I was just thinking about the college football committee yesterday. And so this is a tough, you know, bridge to cross.
Which sounded like a person, which sounded like AI?
The list sounded like AI.
Yes, you know?
Okay.
First, the former.
David?
The former sounded AI-ish.
Okay, you're both wrong. They're both AI.
You're going to do some trick question.
That's what I do. That's what I do. Child of Peter Sagal. Okay, so here's all I know about AI. I used to work for a German software company. And the last several months I was there, I spent a lot of time with the really brilliant people within the company who were working on AI. And all they could tell me, and these were brilliant, brilliant people, was they were terrified of AI.
Sure.
And I said, well, guys, you're the ones responsible for it. And they said they were terrified at how fast it was progressing, how smarter it was all getting. So they were very worried. And I think the book, honestly, by Kissinger and Eric Schmidt and the other guy, Huttenlocher, is about, we need to figure this out before we really unleash it.
Mm-hmm.
David, this time you first and then you, Chuck. How do you feel about AI? And could you ever envision, David, you're in management now. Could you ever envision enlisting AI to cover something?
Oh, you know, I would love to say no, never. I mean, I can't think of a circumstance under which I would, but I can't dismiss it wholly out of hand either, you know.
How about Cincinnati's in a bowl game? You don't want to cover Cincinnati. So.
Well, I'm not covering it, but.
All right, Chuck, ever? Would you ever?
Would I ever? No. But is it going to happen? Yes.
Sure. Is it? How's it going to happen?
I mean, like when you say they're terrified of it, I feel
they're
the same.
Yeah.
And so I feel it's helped me in life to start thinking about in terms of doom and then work back from there. So I just go ahead and assume.
Assume doom. Okay. All right. Next time, David, we will talk about Alice Siebold and
Chucky,
that whole saga. Cause I think it's really interesting and really important, but Amy is with us. Amy Argensinger, welcome to Chatter on Books. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
Great to see you. Great to meet you, even though I can't meet you in person. Okay, so you'll learn quickly. Chatter and Books is not like any one of these other many distinguished, serious, thoughtful
interviews. Oh, I'm picking up on that.
Do you know David and Chuck?
From around the building, sure. It's a big place, but yeah.
It's been a couple of years since everybody's been in the building.
Right?
Right.
I find I don't recognize anyone anymore. Everyone looks different now.
I find people look, and I'm taking hope from this. When I see people I haven't seen for a long time, I go, oh my God, they look so good. And it's because, right?
They're rested. They don't have a commute.
Assuming
they survive this long. Yeah.
Right. There's a little more balance in life. My daughter, Devin, texted me, I don't know, it was last night or whatever. And she goes, oh my God, 2 years ago at whatever time it was the first publicized confirmation of someone who was infected with COVID-19. Two flipping years. Okay. Well, we are thrilled you're with us. Your book, Amy, There She Was, is fabulous.
Thank you.
I have driven everybody in my life crazy for the last couple of weeks because I just kept telling stories. I said, oh my God, you need to hear about this one. But here on Chatter, we like to get the backstory a little bit on the authors. And we would like to know a little bit about where you're from, where you grew up, what you wanted to be when you were five. Did you wear tiaras and practice your tap dancing or something else?
I grew up inside the Beltway. I grew up in Alexandria. I grew up reading the Washington Post, reading it from an early age, a ridiculously early age. I mean, what can I say? I was a prodigy. And I mean, this is, you know, I felt incredibly fortunate to then come work for the Post because I wouldn't say it's the only thing I ever wanted to be, but it was mostly what I wanted to be, a journalist working for the Washington Post. Yes.
Who were your, so we'll shamelessly throw Tony Kornheiser's name around and we have to talk about him. Oh. So tomorrow I can text Tony.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Everything.
When you were a mere child and you read the Washington Post, who did you read? Were there sections you liked or were there people you followed?
You know, as a small child, I mostly read stories about, I read movie reviews. I read anything that was written about the Broadway musical Annie. And I wrote, I read grisly crime stories. So,
nice.
Yeah.
The Metro section had a lot of those. Did you watch that dreadful live thing on NBC the other night of Annie?
Oh, yeah, of course I watched it. It was terrible. Yeah.
Awful. I don't know
how they could have screwed up Annie, but they really did.
No. I think some deep, dark soul in NBC, and I admire from this, has figured out with these live things. Remember the one they did?
They need to give you a disaster every now and then, right?
Well, no, it's hate viewing. They make it so bad.
That's why we watch it.
Yeah.
And that's why Harry Connick Jr. did not shave his head like he should have and put on this terrible, lumpy, you know, bald cap. It was a travesty.
One of my 20-somethings happened to walk through the room when I had that on because I just wanted to hate it. So I was watching, and I like Harry Connick Jr., and I have a Harry Connick Jr. story for another show. And he was walked through and said, who's the homeless guy? Who's the homeless guy they dragged in to watch that? Okay, but I know, and we'll get to this, you were a fan of Miss America many years ago. But as a small child, did you ever think, I'm going to be doing that someday?
No, I never did. And I'll tell you, the crazy thing is that I never watched it until I was like in middle school because it was on too late. I had a hazy notion of what Miss America was. I mean, Phyllis George was a big star when I was growing up. And at some point someone said, oh, you know, Phyllis George, she was a Miss America. And I think that was the first time I'd ever heard of Miss America. But I didn't start watching it until middle school because it was on too late.
David, did you watch as a child? Because it was appointment television. It was produced and there were three networks and it was kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't watch the whole thing. I watched the end because you want to see who won. I was a child of the 70s. Everything was solved in 53 minutes in the last scene, right?
Yeah.
So you tune in the last 10 minutes and you find out who got arrested and who the bad guy was, right?
Yeah.
So
Chuck, did you watch?
Oh, I mean, I assure you, I have not looked up any of this today, okay? But I know that Miss Ohio was Laurie Lee Schaefer in 1972.
One of my favorites,
Terry Ann Musin, that was mentioned, it was Miss Wisconsin. And I think her name was Sean Weatherly.
She was a Miss USA. Miss USA, Sean Weatherly, yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I could probably name you the five finalists, not by name, but in 72, it was like Idaho, Pennsylvania, Maine. I got 4 out of 5. Ohio was the winner. It's a sport, right?
Sports writers get it. Most people don't get it. Sports writers actually get it. Yeah. And I appreciate that.
That's what we do.
Who won? Who lost? And I remember as a small child, and we had one television in our house in the 70s. And by the way, it was black and white. And it just because it was kind of a big deal. It was heavily promoted. And the sponsors, and we'll talk about that, Amy, were a big deal in promoting it. And I remember watching, and I was just a sick child. It's continued to my adulthood. I never wanted to watch the face of the woman who won. I wanted to watch the first runner up.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
I mean, that's the smart thing to do if you have the foresight.
And the control of emotions. And the things that go through, the things that go through her head, because she hears her name and she's crushed. And then the crowd is screaming and yelling because they're really screaming and yelling for the woman who won. Because that's how you know. I'm just sick.
Yeah, they always manage to hold it together pretty well. Sometimes you can catch like a third runner-up, just betray that little oomph of disappointment. But man, this first runner-up, I mean, that's why they get as close as they do, because they hold it together.
Exactly. Okay, let's segue to the book. There she was, The Secret History of Miss America. It's a great cover, by the way. Who did the, do you know who designed the cover? I should know.
You know, some people at Simon & Schuster, like they have this art department that just brought this to me. And I thought, well, okay.
You know what? 1,000 years ago, I had a book published by Simon & Schuster. There was no one there anywhere near as creative as this. Nowhere. This is pretty brilliant.
I thought they did a good job with that. Yeah.
Let's do the Toni Kornheiser connection to the
Miss
America pageant.
I mean, everything I know about pageants, I learned from Toni Kornheiser, and I'm not being at all facetious here.
Explain.
When I started watching the show, Toni Kornheiser was the guy who was covering it for the style section of the Post. The style section took this seriously. I mean, they knew that it was ridiculous in many ways, but they would send their best writers. They would treat it like a writing contest, and they covered the hell out of it. And Toni covered it he was writing about it in 1980. So he covered the pageant at least 1 or 2 years, but he also wrote about the firing of Burt Parks.
Yeah.
He had some scoops on that, I think. Burt Parks, who had been the master of ceremonies for 25 years.
Who made the song famous?
Yeah, exactly. There she is. But, you know, Toni was one of the writers, and I'd say he was probably the best of the bunch who took it seriously. I mean, of course, you know, he had a sense of humor about it. He got all the kitsch, but he treated it like a competition. And for me as a kid, it's like, it's opening my eyes. Like there's something going on here. In a way, it dignified it as like a real event for me.
Right. Well, as much as Toni likes to say, blah, 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 I'm so old, this, that, whatever. Serious as a heart attack journalist. And whatever he covered so well. If people should go back and Google it, some of the stuff he covered on the pageant, go back and look at the profile he wrote of Jim Baker, former Secretary of Treasury, former Secretary of State. He, imagine this, Toni Kornheiser went turkey hunting with Jim Baker. It's one of the most brilliant things I've ever read. But Toni
Kornheiser, incredible reporter, great feature stylist. And, you know, some of the lines he had in these stories, like I looked them up years later, and I remembered these things so vividly. I once, you know, stopped him in the elevator to talk to him about this, and because he had written more recently, like, you know, maybe 20 years ago, he had written another column about it. I'm like, oh, hey, so did you actually watch the show this weekend? And he's like, of course I did. And then he proceeds to like analyze it, like as dead serious as if he's talking about the Redskins game. And his insights are great. I mean, he just, it is a sport, and he gets
it. It was like when David Broder, all-time political icon reporter, covered, was it David Archery at one of the Olympics?
I don't know, but
David Broder wanted to go to one of the Olympics. I don't remember, it might have been LA, might have been Atlanta, I don't remember.
Everybody wanted to go to the Olympics.
Yeah, and so he went to...
Political people always just magically showed up at Olympics.
Okay, but David, the political people don't show up and say, I just want to go, I'll cover anything, which is what David Broder did. And they said, okay, archery.
But you have to do that. That is the deal.
That's the entry level job. And
you have to cover whatever needs covered.
Archery one.
Greco-Roman wrestling. Never had been to a single wrestling match in my life before that day. Do the best you can.
And within within 15 minutes, you're already firing the coach, you know?
Exactly.
Right. Chuck, what was the, you've been to so many Olympics. What was the first one you covered?
Barcelona, 1992.
Oh, nice.
That was mine too.
Was it? Mm-hmm. Did you just hang out together?
I didn't know. It was too big. I will tell you, to bring this full circle though, you mentioned someone earlier in the show. We're in Barcelona, Spain, and you know Barcelona, they eat late.
Great city.
It's fantastic city. So we're told that the place to be is a nightclub called Up and Down. Doesn't open till 3 in the morning. Okay. We can't get in. It's me and Mike Wilbon. We can't get into Up and Down at 3 in the morning. And somebody says, Wilbon, come over here. Come on, I'll walk you in. Orenthal James Simpson.
Yay!
Swear to God.
Oh, that's so great. That is so great.
True.
Oh, you know, it just means being in the right place at the right time, David. Wow. Right place at the right time. Okay. All right, Amy, back to you in this fabulous book. There she was. Mm-hmm. It is as much a social commentary as it's, I mean, it clearly, we'll do the Jamie McIntyre question on the show. It is looking back at 100 years of history of this pageant and incredible stories, and we'll get to some of them. But it is as much a social commentary of what has been going on and how the role of women, the perception of women and women's place in society and work and everything else has been evolving as it is about these women themselves who are remarkable. But what did you set out to write? Did you know it was going to be that? Did you know it was going to be a social commentary? Or did you just set out to say, these are some pretty fascinating stories?
I set out to tell the story about, you know, what had happened. I figured it was going to be the rise and fall. How did it become such a big deal?
Oh, interesting.
And then what happened to cause it to all fall apart? You know, right. When I started in on this, there had been basically the Miss America Civil War, a lot of bloodletting, people, you know, grappling for control of it. I knew that you had this dynamic where former Miss Americas were trying to seize control of it, you know, imprint it with their own image.
Sure.
And then they ended up fighting amongst themselves. What I found, though, when I started digging into the stories is I wouldn't say it tracked the women's movement, but I kind of followed the women's movement from a few steps behind. I mean, the young women who entered Miss America were pretty mainstream middle America girls. Mm-hmm. You know, they were picked to win these small town pageants by like the Junior Chamber of Commerce. They were not radicals. They were not rabble rousers. You know, they were very pretty vanilla.
Yeah.
But what you see is, you know, the women's movement had started to challenge the whole idea of a pageant as paternalistic and objectifying and sexist. And the pageant kind of didn't know what to do about this. But while the leaders of the group were agonizing over this, what happened is that the young women who were competing were changing because the times were changing. You know, they were baby boomers at this point, you know, starting in the early 70s. And just by nature of being a baby boomer, they had been raised to, you know, question authority. Now, granted, these were not the women who are going out and being on the vanguard of any protest, but they were just different from the kids who had come up in the 1960s. They had grown up in these crowded classrooms. They were kind of used to asserting themselves more. And so that's what happened to the pageant, is that you started to have kind of, it became populated by these more assertive young women, some of whom were perfectly happy to sit in front of a microphone and say, well, yeah, I think a woman should have a right to choose. Well, yeah, I've tried marijuana. Yeah. And that kind of made the pageant a little more interesting at a time when it was about to fall off the cultural radar.
Yeah. At a time when sponsors like, was it Pepsi that dumped them in the late 60s?
Pepsi dumped them in about 68 or 69. Yeah.
And what did they say? Our core audience is more urban, more hip. Or
yeah. Basically, it's like, we're going after cool, urban, young people. And this is not Miss America.
Which was my first surprise with the pageant world, high school outside of Pittsburgh, Laura McLeod, older sister of a guy in my class. Anyway, she was in the pageant world. And it was very unusual in this particular school for someone to do that. And it was a pretty intense school, not for me, because I just sat on a bench and tried to find out where the next party was. And anyways, this young lady, Laura, was in the pageant world, and we kind of supported her. We would go to these small pageants in shopping malls outside Pittsburgh. But one of the things you learned is how what incredible hard work it was.
Oh, yeah.
Because she really, so it's the it, part of the book, there she was, it's about the surprise of these young women, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I would walk into these local pageants, and what would surprise me was, you know, you hear the stereotypes that, you know, you think they're all going to be throwing hairbrushes at each other and stealing each other's shoes.
No, yeah.
No, I mean, they can't, because these girls do it over, women, they are on this competition circuit over and over. This is their hobby. So they see these other competitors. It's like, you know, seeing, you know, the guy on who's on the half marathon circuit with you. It's he's not your enemy. He's your comrade. Yeah. And, you know, and these are the only people who get what they're doing. So they have a nice kind of surprising sense of
there's almost community. A bonding. If you're looking, when you buy, listeners, when you buy this book, There She Was, which you should, it's a great holiday book to buy. If you're looking for Tonya Harding trying to beat up on Nancy Kerrigan, it's not there. And that is something my friend, Laura McLeod, older sister, my friend Scott, it's so hard and it's such a niche. And there were so many, that was the late 70s. And there were so many parts of the world who said, this is not a cool thing to be doing. There's almost this bonding. We're in the foxhole together, supportive of each other. Okay, let's talk about some of the famous ones. David, who's your favorite famous Miss America? And we'll ask Amy about her.
Ty.
Oh, good one.
It's a tie. Vanessa Williams and Phyllis George, of course.
Yeah, That's it's very hard to choose.
Yeah, Phyllis, they are both fabulous. And I actually stood 2 feet from Vanessa Williams, and I thought I was going to turn into a pillar of salt. That's how beautiful she was. Yeah.
She's amazing. And if you go back and watch her pageant in 1983, you can find it on YouTube.
Yep.
She was extraordinary. I mean, just hands down, anyone could have seen that she was going to win. Gorgeous, all the poise in the world, and an incredibly gifted, advanced singer. I mean, she was extraordinary. I got to know Phyllis George. Phyllis died about a year and a half ago. When she was, you know, when I started the book, I reached out to her daughter, who is Pamela Brown of CNN. Right. And I said, Pamela, you need to put me in touch with your mother. She's the most important person I can talk to for this book. And Phyllis was everything you hope for and more. I mean, people will talk about her, even people who have nothing to do with pageants. People tell you stories about the one time they were in a room with Phyllis George, and they talk about it like the one time they were in a room with Obama or Sinatra. I mean, she had that kind of like energy, that kind of charisma. And of course, I mean, incredible gift for gab, like you saw on television on NFL Today. I mean, she could talk. She could just, she had stories. Yeah. She had supreme self-confidence, great energy. You know, her story really became interesting after she was Miss America. She, you know, she was kind of a generational change maker. She was done being Miss America, but she didn't want to go back home. She didn't want to get married yet. Yeah. Didn't want to start college or finish college. She had had a taste of fame and she wanted more, but she didn't quite have, you know, a natural skill set. It wasn't like she was an actress or a singer. There wasn't a natural niche for her. And she was going out on auditions. And then she met Bob Wessler, who was the head of CBS Sports, who was looking to put a woman in the broadcasting booth. And he made small talk with her for about 30 minutes and offered her a job, because he sensed that she had something really special that was going to be great on TV. And it was, it worked. And it wasn't just that she was the first woman to be a regular presence in one of these jobs. She also, I mean, she changed sports broadcasting in a way we're so used to now. Just she dealt all the softer side stuff, which they just didn't really have a whole lot of before.
And also, it's a bit of a cliche now, but she broke a lot of barriers for the women who followed her.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Totally. Absolutely. Broke. I mean, she, and it's not as though she worked her way up from the bottom to end up, you know, on the anchor desk of these big sporting events. She went right in at the top, which was very hard, to your point, I'm sure. But she broke the barrier for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, you didn't even have a whole lot of women in TV news at the time. And there she is in sports, which is so male dominated. She really broke the mold.
Yeah. Okay. Is it oversimplifying things to say that in many ways, these Miss America, usually the winners, really started to develop the platform by which famous people, they might be artists, they might be athletes, they might be whatever, start to have causes. So when I was going through the book, I just thought, oh my God. I mean, you had Miss Americas who advocated for, you know, on behalf of AIDS victims, on behalf of people with disabilities. The list goes on and on. Domestic abuse, really remarkable, pretty brave given the environment in which they're working. But is it, and David and Claude, I mean, Chuck, tell me if I'm wrong, but it almost seems when I look back, they were the first celebrities, if you will, to say, we need a platform or I want a platform. Now everybody does, right? Amy, sure. First.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you'd always had celebrities here and there who had their causes, their issues, you know, save the whales or nuclear disarmament or whatever. But what we've seen in more recent years is something that Miss America, I would say, started, which is it became part of the program where they wanted to dignify it. They wanted to, you know, give more meaning to the crown at a time when it was kind of searching for something. And so they required that all the Miss Americas take up a cause. Does that seem a little hokey? It is a little hokey. You know, you're basically saying, okay, I got to find a cause. I got to brush up on this topic. I got to brush up on homelessness or AIDS or whatever.
Right.
But having said that, I mean, it did give the organization a lot more texture and a bit more dignity. And what you saw a decade later is every celebrity does that. It's kind of the Angelina Jolie model. I mean, where now, you know, I saw a decade ago, you'd have every celebrity coming to Washington and they would want to have a cause.
Yeah.
And in some cases, they would even hook up with consultants who would help them find the right cause.
Guilty. My favorite is these people with, you know, I've worked at big agencies, small agencies, Amy, it doesn't matter. Anyways, they call, okay, we want to talk about, you know, and they always have some bullshit phrase about it, but what cause they want to, and you'd start to ask kind of deep, meaningful, open-ended questions about what they really care about. Well, what should I care about? Anyway. Chuck, do you have a favorite Miss America winner or memory?
I have a sad story that I must confess.
Go ahead.
I was in a gym in downtown Lexington. I was a Kentuckian for 9 years. Still consider myself one. But
you got that great accent. That's why we love you. It's a real accent. I like Brian Kelly.
A gym in downtown Lexington. One of those gyms that had like a little restaurant attached to it. You know, you could eat dinner there too. And it was Friday night at 8:45. So only the hard boots were in there.
Yeah.
And working out in the gym wasn't very big, was just myself and Phyllis George. That was
fantastic.
Former first lady, of course.
Oh, that's such a good story.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't forget, she was first lady of Kentucky.
Right. Yeah, that's right. John Weinbrow, right?
Yep.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know who I was working for at the time, but I went to a fundraiser once for John Weinbrow in Kentucky and she was there. And she was completely owns a room.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm hanging out on the sidelines talking to, and she comes up to goes, isn't this a bunch of BS? I said, yes. so how was she working out and what were you doing, Chuck? And was she more like lifting more weight than you were?
Yeah, basically. Well, she was more she was doing like she was doing difficult stuff.
Yeah.
But and I was a columnist at the newspaper, so I could have walked over there and said, you know, I should have called her often for my column, which I never did, but I was far too timid to go over there and say hello. So
yeah,
that's sad to me.
She was intimidating because, to Amy's point, she just owned a room. It wasn't as though she was the best at any individual thing, but wherever she
George,
was,
man, come on.
Yeah. Oh my God, 6:47. Okay. Amy, is there still a Miss America pageant 50 years from now?
Oh, I don't know if there's going to be a Miss America pageant 1 year from now. I'll be honest. It's in bad, bad shape. The next pageant, this is its 100-year anniversary, but you know, the
amazing
pageant has moved from Atlantic City to the Mohegan Sun Casino in Uncasville, Connecticut. It's no longer in September. It's in the middle of December. And, you know, it's no longer on network television. It's going to be streamed on Peacock. And I know people like say streaming is the way of the future, but if it were still hit, it would be on network television and it would be streaming.
Yeah.
So I don't see a way and television, that was its bread and butter. You know, it made its money off of television and sponsorships. I honestly, in the years I took to write this book, I saw the community shrinking on the local level. It's just, there's so many other things a young woman can do these days. And the audience just isn't there anymore. That's why the book is called There She Was.
I hope this is not the, you know, obituary. I hope it's not. Because, okay, let's get you out with this. Talk about how the, and you cannot categorize, you cannot generalize, but talk about how the profile of the young women competing in this have changed over the 100 years. Because you look at the ones, and I would not have looked at them if it weren't for your book, There She Was. They're really interesting young women who come from a variety of backgrounds, and they are in the military, and they're this, right? And you've got an indie guitarist who's one of the recent ones, great people. But how there are still some of them in there, not as many there used to be. But who is the woman, who is the young woman who's competing in maybe 2021 or 2022 in the Miss America pageant?
Who is she?
Yeah.
I mean, these days, I have to say, most of them are young women who have had, who have been competing in pageants since they were teenagers.
Right.
They got the bug 10 years ago. They're going to keep trying until they can finally make it. You know, it's a nice range of people. They're all nice people. They're all fairly smart for the most part. It's very, very engaging people. You know, it's, you no longer have the stories where it's a Vanessa Williams, who's just, you know, this super talent who's in a college production and they beg her to enter the pageant. Anyone who's doing it now has been part of that niche community for a while. And like you say, some of them have military experience. Some of them are pursuing careers in the sciences. You know, they don't all want to be anchor women or dancers anymore. But you know, it is a increasingly closed small community.
Well, I hope it keeps going. Okay. The book is There She Was, The Secret History of Miss America. Everyone should buy it. All right. Our featured author, Amy Arkitzinger. Amy, thank you so much for joining us. The book is There She Was. That's the most creative cover Simon Schuster has done in decades, America. I want you to see that. A little bit of housekeeping and then we'll get out. So we are back next week with Barrett Holmes Pittner, who is a really interesting guy. He comes to us by way of Alex Dobert, who helps keep the show going sometimes. He is a writer, a columnist, a filmmaker, and he's written this really fascinating book called A Crime Without a Name. And it's his take on if we started changing the vocabulary we use and the way we talk about things like race and culture, literally changing the vocabulary that we use, we might have more meaningful conversations and make more progress. So pretty fascinating guy. Really upbeat and positive leading to the holiday season. I just want to know. And David, you'll be happy to know, since that topic is above my head, Maroa Yejide is coming back to spend some time with us next week and talk about all her success this year.
Fantastic.
So everybody, what's that? Because of us. Maroa, S.A. Cosby, Robert Jones Jr., Sanjana Sathian. There's another one I'm forgetting, but they're all winning.
The Secret Lives of Church Ladies.
Deshafilia.
Deshafilia.
He's crushing. Yeah. Yes. Deshafilia barely answers my emails anymore. Barely. That's a sign. She's doing so well.
That's great.
So everybody, thank you for listening. Somebody, I'm going to offer like 3 Chatter on Books mugs to the person who puts up another review on Apple. Because the guy, Amy, a guy has declared that David and I are racist. Apple iTunes review, and we're a little upset
by
this.
Sorry, just tell me what race I hate.
I'm not sure. So we need somebody else to post a review, so that's not the first one that pops up.
I can do that. Yeah,
thank you. But Amy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. This is great fun.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
David, love you. Chuck, love you. Everybody, come back. And everybody, keep listening and stay well. And we'll talk to you soon.